Welcome. Today is Tuesday, the 23rd of June, 2015, in a beautiful sunny morning here in North Idaho. And I'm joined from Virginia, where no doubt they're turning down the air conditioners in response to the Pope's encyclical, by Chris Ferreira, president of the Catholic Lawyers Association, prolific writer for The Remnant and many other periodicals, and the author of three books, The Great Facade, The Church of the Libertarian, and Liberty, the God That Failed. Chris, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm happy to be on the show, especially with the topic at hand.
Indeed.
New encyclical.
Before we get into that, I imagine almost everyone in my Catholic audience is familiar with who you are, but they might not know. How did you get started writing, I guess, for The Remnant? How did you get started supporting and advocating for the traditional Mass?
Well, I have publicly confessed to having gone through a pagan phase in my life. If you Google the article, you'll find something about me having been at Woodstock. And I came back to the church in my late 20s, and I came back directly from the Latin Mass to the Latin Mass. I bypassed the whole Novus Ordo debacle. And after I came back to the church from my wandering and back to the traditional Mass, I began to think about what was going on in the church. That led me to coming up with the idea, based in part on what Michael Davies had said, that the church has been infected by the intellectual equivalent of viruses, these things that seem to be living but really aren't living. They are apparent ideas but really aren't ideas. Something between inchoate and something intellectually perceivable. And those would be the novelties of the post-conciliar epic. So three of them in particular interested me. One would be, of course, ecumenism. The other would be dialogue. And the third would be collegiality. All of these concepts are, by their very nature, imprecise. But the first two, ecumenism and dialogue, elude definition. You can describe them, of course. You can talk about what people do when they engage in ecumenism, what they do when they engage in dialogue. But doctrinally speaking, they're utterly meaningless. And yet, like viruses, which are not fully living things, they infect living things and cause weakness in organisms by hijacking the cells, in this case, the real ideas of the church, and using those real teachings of the church to make copies of themselves so that everything the church teaches is infected by these ideas. And so we see, of course, in the church today, everything is infected by dialogue. The church no longer preaches to the world, it dialogues. And ecumenism has demissionized the church. We no longer proselytize. Proselytism says the current occupant of the See of Peter is solemn nonsense. So ecumenism and dialogue have paralyzed the church the way viruses paralyze a living organism. So I wrote an article about this called Viruses in the Body of Christ. Michael Matt of the Remnant read the article, invited me to give a talk on it at a Remnant conference, I believe it was the year 2000, and that flourished into a collaboration that has grown ever since, 15 years now.
Excellent. So let's get into the encyclical then, Laudato Si, which I don't know if it, in the long run it will be remembered to have an enormous impact, but certainly it has a number of things, some things that I read that I thought were good and some things that, well, are really concerning. So in the first place, what's the normal function of a papal encyclical? Do popes normally address specifically non-Christians or scientific issues?
Well, the popes have never addressed non-Christians, or for that matter, Catholics, on scientific issues. They prescind from scientific issues because they're not scientists. Never in the history of the church has any pope presumed to pronounce on matters as technical as, for example, in this encyclical, the levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The pope takes a position on this. It's mind-boggling. Now, when we're talking about climate change in this encyclical, first of all, there's the novelty of addressing everyone in the world. Now, that can be done in the context of presenting some truth of the faith that you would like the world to know about. But to write an encyclical for the world in essentially worldly terms that the world will not find offensive, and then, as is done in this encyclical, at around paragraph 263, tack on some Catholic spirituality for the Catholics, and even that is rather bland, to do this is absolutely unprecedented. Now, when you're talking about climate change as a so-called science, you're not talking really about science. The Pope doesn't cite a single scientific paper or other scientific source in this document, which should not even be discussing science in the first place. But if you're going to do that, well, cite a source. There's nothing. He simply assumes the truth of the fundamental claims of the climate change fanatics. And what you're dealing with here is not science, but an ideology. And this is why you hear things about climate change deniers. What are they denying? Are they denying hotly disputed scientific claims? No, they're denying a dogma, according to these people. We must believe in climate change. The alarming thing here is who the Pope has been consulted on this pseudoscience, which is really a dogma. For example, we have the watershed event of the workshop, and when you hear the word workshop in Catholic circles, run for the hills, the workshop back in April, which featured an opening address by Ban Ki-moon, the pro-abortion UN Secretary General, brief statements by Professor Jeffrey Sachs, the pro-abortion director of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network, and a total screwball, Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber, if I pronounced his name correctly, I'm not even sure, who was just appointed to the Pontifical Academy for Science. Another pro-abort, a climate change fanatic, who talks about 2-degree tipping points past which the entire Earth will be destroyed, who advocates a one-world government, who has the dream of a global democratic society featuring an Earth constitution, a global council, and a planetary court. This Earth constitution, says Schellnhuber, would actually transcend the UN Charter, which is bad enough, and the global council would be, and I'm quoting, an assembly of individuals elected directly by all people on Earth. And the planetary court would be, and I'm quoting, a transnational legal body open to appeals from everybody. These are the screwballs that the Pope is associated with. And one of them, this Schellnhuber, was actually chosen from all of the people in the world to be one of the presenters of this papal encyclical. That is absolutely staggering. It's almost surreal. Now, talking about the so-called science involved in this, the Heartland Institute desperately attempted to intervene and present to the Pope contrary scientific evidence. And they were mocked and ridiculed by the Vatican bureaucrats as Tea Partiers. This is ludicrous. These people aren't Tea Partiers. They're serious Catholics. They're traditional Catholics. And they're alarmed about the Pope's embrace of junk science presented to him by pro-abortion lunatics. Let's not mince words here. These people are crazy. And the lunatics are running the asylum insofar as this entire climate change invasion of the Vatican is concerned. Let's talk about some of the science involved. I'm using here a Forbes magazine summary of the climate change reconsidered paper presented by the Heartland Institute. This involves 50 top scientists, according to Forbes magazine, organized into a panel, a non-governmental international panel on climate change. The publication, says Forbes, is double peer-reviewed, and it presents some of the conclusions of the so-called climate change deniers, who are actually legitimate scientists who say that climate change is hokum. This report notes that global warming lasted 20 years from the 70s to the 90s. Before that, there were 30 years of cooling. It notes that for the last 18 years, and this was as of 2014, so now we're into the 19th year, there hasn't been any global warming. And then it notes that Britain's MET, or Met Office, which is a nexus for the international climate change fanatics, admitted that there would be no further global warming through 2017. So that would make 22 years without global warming, according to scientific data that really are not seriously contestable. And Forbes magazine asks, and this is a very pertinent question the Pope should have addressed, and I quote, "When the period of no global warming gets longer than the period of global warming, what is the climate trend then?" Then it moves over to the other concern in this encyclical, which we can get to, I guess, later in the discussion, about environmental quality, the quality of life of people, which the Pope also apparently has simply assumed without benefit of opposing views is on the downtrend, so that the entire world is mired in misery. Well, the Forbes magazine article notes that, I'm here talking about a human events summary. The human events summary of environmental quality indicators is based upon a United Nations report. And the United Nations report says that the indicator risk for drinking water has decreased by 60% between 1973 and 1996. Soil erosion is not increasing, but decreasing, having declined 41% between 1982 and 2010. U.S. air quality has improved between 1980 and 2013 in the following ways. Ozone down 33%, nitrogen dioxide 54 to 60% decline, sulfur dioxide 81% decline, carbon monoxide 84% decline, lead 92% decline, particulate matter down 34% between 2000 and 2013. Human Events cites the 2014 Millennium Development Goals report from the United Nations on how much people have to share in terms of resources in the world. And according to Human Events, the UN itself admits that the share of the world's people, and I'm quoting, without sustainable access to safe drinking water was cut in half. Between 1990 and 2012, the share of the world's population with access to improved water sources increased, according to the UN, from 76 to 89%, meaning, as this article states, 2.3 billion people gained access to improved sources of drinking water. In developing regions, according to the same report from the United Nations, the proportion of undernourished people dropped 24% from 1990 to 14% in 2011-2013. The proportion of the children of the world under the age of 5 estimated to have stunted growth dropped from 40 to 25%. The global adult mortality rate declined between 1990 and 2013 from 198 to 152 per 1,000. The mortality rate for children under the age of 5 dropped 50% from 90 to 48 per 1,000 live births between 1990 and 2012. The maternal mortality rate dropped from 45% in 1990 to dropped 45% between 1990 and 2013, from 380 to 210 deaths per 100,000 live births. And finally, life expectancy between 1990 and 2013 increased by 6 years to age 21. Now, jumping back to the climate change issue, we note increasing evidence that the sun is the dominant influence on the Earth's temperatures. According to the London Economist, solar activity, particularly sunspot cycles, is beginning to mimic the pattern seen during the Ice Age. The Economist cites a German scientist, or rather a Russian scientist, I can't even pronounce his last name, Abu Samatov, from the St. Petersburg's Pulkovo Astronomical Observatory. And he predicted in 2005 an unavoidable advance towards a deep temperature drop because of sunspot activity. The London Economist also notes something else. The Pacific Decadal Oscillation, PDO, which means essentially that every 20 or 30 years, the cold water at the bottom of the oceans comes up to the top, which cools the atmosphere till the sun warms the water. And that cycle keeps going, warming and cooling. Now we have, according to the London Economist, 73 different climate models proposed by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And as the London Economist notes, the warming trends, and I'm quoting, projected by these models are all diverging further and further from the real-world trend of actual temperatures. In other words, this science is becoming fantasy science. So I'll wrap up this part of our interview by saying, by way of conclusion, this encyclical, in terms of its attempt to address scientific issues, is, I can only put it this way, embarrassingly ill-informed. It's a Johnny-come-lately to the whole question of environmentalism, and it offers nothing substantial to the discussion of these questions beyond generic expressions of concern for the environment. And we're all concerned about the environment. Nobody wants to see environmental abuses. But the attempt to adopt this scientific fact, the junk science claims of the climate change fanatics, when there's a growing mountain of scientific evidence that this is bunk, it's just embarrassing. Embarrassing.
I would agree, and there's also the economic aspect that really can't be ignored. We talk about fossil fuels, but an increasing number of geologists are questioning whether they're fossil at all, and I don't know if anyone's actually stopped to think of a cause and effect model by which dinosaur bones and fossilized plankton suddenly becomes oil. But the staggering amounts of bones you need piled up in one area just to suddenly, you're thinking like a Borg-sized cube of dinosaurs in Saudi Arabia that eventually over millions of years becomes fossil fuels, where increasingly European scientists are finding that it's actually magma chamber reactions in the Earth, and there's a lot of scientific literature being produced on it. It's not allowed to be produced in the United States. No institution will look at it, because everyone knows Nixon took us off the gold standard. Nobody, a lot of people, and some economists know this, but a lot of people don't, is that, well, the dollar still had to be backed by something, and it's backed by oil, because the dollar became the reserve currency for oil, or the so-called petrodollar. So the strength of the dollar depends on oil sales being done. And what that functionally means is that if you're in, say, Sarajevo, and your country wants to buy oil, well, they can't just buy oil. They need to buy dollars in order to buy oil, which means their currency has to have a certain value in order to acquire dollars. We don't have to do that. We just print up the dollars. And that's a huge boon to the American economy. And, of course, we control that price and the value of the dollar by getting all the oil companies and OPEC in line and say, we're only going to produce this much and not this much. And then if that, because the truth is, the world's awash in oil. Everyone can actually get, Israel's doing explorations in oil. The whole Mediterranean basin is full of oil. And that just could not be if it was merely a fossil fuel reaction. Plus, they're finding, I forget when they discovered that. It's when that probe, the Cassini probe, dropped on Saturn's moon Titan. And they found there's petroleum vastly beyond what exists on the Earth. Well, there are no dinosaurs on Saturn's moon Titan.
Well,
so,
this is one of the hoary myths spawned by the ideology of evolution, another pseudoscience, which is actually an ideology. The idea that oil is being produced basically in a steady state environmental operation beneath the surface of the Earth, there's increasing evidence for that. And I find it most ironic that the Pope, who's talking about the Earth as God's gift to man, doesn't seem to notice that this superabundance of oil beneath the Earth is part of divine providence. He also doesn't seem to notice the scientific finding, also reported by The Economist, quoted in Forbes, that while over the past 15 years, and I'm quoting here, air temperatures have been flat, greenhouse gas emissions have soared. There's also a life cycle involving carbon dioxide, which happens to be very good for plants. Plants take in the carbon dioxide and produce oxygen. Maybe that explains why temperatures have been flat, while greenhouse gases have continued to soar, so-called greenhouse gases. So where is the Pope's understanding of the fact that fossil fuels, so-called, may actually be part of divine providence?
Well, I, considering who's advising him, I don't think he's ever come to that conclusion. And also, if you look at what Hugh Owen of the Kolbe Center, I had him on to talk about evolution. You know, it's in my interview archive. I'll link that up in the notes here. Well, he was talking, but not in that interview, but another place, he was talking about how when Pope Benedict was Pope, they'd presented in Rome, the Kolbe Center. And Benedict, they'd had a chance to meet with Benedict when he was still a cardinal. Actually, yeah, I'm mistaken here. It was when John Paul II was Pope, And Benedict was a cardinal, Cardinal Ratzinger, and they met with him, and he was fascinated by what they presented, but he said, but I still have a problem, because how do you explain fossil fuels and all these things that have to, you know, develop? And they explained, oh, you missed it. We had a guy, you know, yesterday, he left yesterday, he was talking about that. So, you know, they just don't hear this information, because the body that writes papers for them and advises them are all establishment scientists, many of them atheists, and they elect their own members, the Pontifical Academy of the Sciences. It doesn't have any magisterial authority whatsoever, but that's who they go to get their information on any scientific issue.
Well, that's why I refer to the Pontifical Academy of Science as a Pontifical Academy of Atheists. A huge percentage of them are atheists, evolutionists. What are they doing in the Vatican? And why are they giving advice to the Pope on God's creation? They don't believe in God's creation. It's absurd. So the science in this encyclical is bad. It's naive. It's unsupported by a single reference, and it's a Johnny-come-lately, as I say, to the environmental discussion. I don't know why the Pope is involving himself in this this issue. Now, of course, in terms of the use of fossil fuels and the whole technocratic paradigm, I certainly would agree with Francis that there's overuse of these things, that people are afflicted by a consumerist mentality, that there are environmental abuses all over the world, that consumerism has run rampant. All of this is true, but this can be discussed in the context of general moral instruction for the members of the church. And if the Pope wishes to address these arguments based on the natural law to a wider audience, he can do so. But situating these discussions of moral questions about abuses in terms of consumption in the midst of climate change hysteria is a monumental blunder on the part of this Pope, because he's positioned himself in the midst of a debate in which he has no competence whatsoever, and he pitches his argument to the world based on apocalyptic predictions about climate change that are obviously being falsified by the day. And there's a really enormous irony here. You might remember John the 23rd's opening address to the council, where he made fun of the prophets of gloom. Who were these prophets of gloom, Ryan? They were the popes before the Second Vatican Council, who, one after another, especially the popes Pius VII, VIII, IX, X, XI, were warning about an apocalypse in the moral order, because men had apostatized. The new order was taking over and destroying the remnants of Christendom. Men were losing the faith, turning away from God and his law. And the result, Pope Leo said, would be final disaster. The result, Pius XI said, would be that civilization is tottering to its fall. John the 23rd makes fun of these prophets of gloom. But now we're supposed to listen, irony of ironies, to the pseudoscientific prophets of gloom, who tell us that the world is about to destroy itself, and that the Pope, persuaded by this nonsense, says we must act here and now to enact radical changes to the way we live. Really? So then the Vatican's going to turn off all its air conditioners, they're going to stop using automobiles, and the Pope will stop taking jet rides all over the world, spewing carbon exhaust everywhere? That's not going to happen. And if it doesn't happen, if the Vatican doesn't basically go green in the most radical way, now what are we to conclude but that the climate change aspect of this encyclical, these prophecies of doom, is just a lot of talk?
Indeed. So let's proceed to the encyclical. The original for it is Italian. There's no Latin original that we can find. It seems that since the synod last year, where the Pope said that the normal language will be Italian, I guess in a non-official sense, Latin is no longer the formal language of the Church.
It would seem. My understanding is, and I could be wrong, that there will not be a Latin official edition of this, that the Italian will be the main document, and everything will be translated from that. I could be wrong, but that was my impression.
Mine as well. I don't even know how a lot of these concepts would translate into Latin. I do a lot of work with English to Latin, and then, of course, I'm a professional translator from Latin, so I don't know quite how you would do it. I suppose it could be done. But anyway, first off, are there certain significant differences in meaning between the Italian original and the official translation in English?
There are numerous crucial differences, but I think the best way to handle that question is to address them as we go through the other questions, because that's where they crop up. So as we go through these other issues, I'll try to indicate to you where the crucial difference is between the English translation, which is unofficial, and the Italian translation are to be found. And some of those differences are quite revealing.
All right, so then the first thing is in your remnant article on the encyclical, you object to the Pope's language in number 62, where he uses the term insedere. And I'll read part of the Italian, it's lengthy, but he starts out, perché inserire in questo documento rivolto a tutte le persone di buona volontà in capitolo riferito alle convinzioni di fede? Which right. I've translated for, why insert into this document, addressed to all people of goodwill, a chapter related to the convictions of faith? And he goes on, in my translation from the Italian, and correct me if I made a mistake, I'm aware that in the field of politics and thought, some strongly reject to the idea of a creator, or are considered irrelevant, a point to be relegated to the realm of an irrational opulence that religions can offer anything to an integral ecology and the full development of the human race. Other times, it is assumed that they account for a subculture that simply must be tolerated. However, science and religion, which provide different approaches to reality, may come into a sustained and productive relationship for both. So now, you objected to this language as if he's adding the faith as an afterthought, but this does come early in this encyclical. Couldn't it be said that the Pope, since he addressed the world, similar to John the 23rd in Mater et Magistra, or Pacem in Terris, that he's now turning to the faithful whom he's also addressing? Could it be that he just doesn't understand that the what you call the pejorative nature of the term inserire, since Italian's not his first language?
Well, first of all, let's talk about the idea of inserting into a papal encyclical the convictions of the faith, because the phrase in Italian is perché inserire in questo documento rivolto a tutte le persone di buona volontà un capitolo riferito alle convinzioni di fede, the convictions of faith, meaning, I presume, the Christian faith. He doesn't like to use the words Catholic faith. Now, the English translation is, why should this document addressed to all people of goodwill include a chapter dealing with the convictions of believers? So all of a sudden, the convictions of faith becomes the convictions of believers, all believers, Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, whatever. That's the first problem. Now, getting to the question of whether you use the word insert, as he does in Italian, or the English translation, why should this document include a chapter dealing with the convictions of believers? Isn't the question itself preposterous? This is the Vicar of Christ writing an encyclical. It's his function as the Vicar of Christ, first, foremost, always, everywhere, to present the faith, not junk science, not environmentalism. So here we have the spectacle of the Pope saying in chapter 2, oh, by the way, let's have a chapter on religion. And what is the reason for this religious contribution, as he puts it? Well, listen to what he says. He says that religions can make I'll quote it directly from the English. They dismiss as irrational the rich contributions which religions can make towards an integral ecology and the full development of humanity. And that's pretty much what the Italian says. The contribution that religions can make toward an integral ecology and the full development of humanity. Coming from the Vicar of Christ, I have to say this in all candor, this is absurd. Religion doesn't make a contribution to integral ecology and the full development of humanity. The revelation of Jesus Christ, his gospel, the law of the gospel, which animated an entire civilization for more than 15 centuries, is the only way to reach the full development of humanity. In the state of sanctifying grace, nourished by the sacraments, kept alive by the helps that the church provides to mankind. The church doesn't make a contribution to the full development of humanity. The church provides the full development of humanity. And outside of the church, not only do we not have the full development of humanity, we have total depravity throughout the world because Western civilization has rejected the social kingship of Christ, has rejected anything like the Christian commonwealth, and has adopted as its received wisdom every single error condemned as such in the Syllabus of Errors of Pius IX. And that's why Pius XI warned in the 1920s that civilization was tottering to its fall because it had rejected the social kingship of Christ, meaning the operation of his law in the laws and institutions of all nations on the face of the earth, not just Catholic nations, and not just in the life of the individual, but in the lives of collectives, meaning political society and the nation state. So the idea that he's going to insert chapter 2 in a papal encyclical about all the important things that religion can contribute to the full development of humanity is, I have to say it, ridiculous. The Vicar of Christ should be leading the world back to Christ. That is job one for the Roman pontiff, and this has been completely forgotten in the confusion of the post-conciliar epoch. This is the heart of the crisis in the church.